okay.
Okay, today is Monday, March 5th. The quorum being present, Committee on Local Government Elections will come to order. First bill on the agenda is Senate File 2043. Good afternoon, Senator Chamberlain. There's an amendment. Would you want to offer your amendment? Or?
Mr. Chair, are we doing the felon voting or the 2127 first? 2043 is felon voting. Is that one we're going to do first?
On the agenda, it's Senate File 2043.
Okay. Switching gears, Mr. Chair, a moment.
I'd like to move the A5 amendment.
I would.
A5 amendment. Discussion on the A5 amendment. And all those in favor of adoption of the A5 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment's adopted.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. This bill is a result of the governor's task force on election integrity. Over the interim, we met many times. Secretary of State Ritchie was a co-chair of that committee, along with, and the other members served on the committee as well. Senator Sieben, Representative Benson, Representative Simon, members from corrections, judiciary, and various other aspects, various other departments and organizations in the state. The goal of the commission was simply to find a way to improve our felon voting process. Currently, it's illegal to vote if you're a felon, but there's never been really a process to deal with that. So we have done in this bill, or as a result of the recommendation of the task force, and in a nutshell, what it does is it develops new ways to prevent, detect, and then make it easier to prosecute felons if they voted, as well as helping to ease some of the restrictions and constraints on the local election officials. I believe what we have here is a pretty good piece of work, but it still needs appropriate attention and review. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Frazier, and she can go through the pieces of it a little bit better than I.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, my name is Beth Frazier with the Office of the Secretary of State. And as Senator Chamberlain said, this does reflect the recommendations of the Task Force on Election Integrity. And the first section establishes an administrative procedure for cases in which someone who is believed to be ineligible to vote submits a voter registration application. This will allow the county auditor to provide the individual with a notice that they will not be processing the registration without further action on the part of the applicant. Right now, current law requires that every voter registration application be processed. So if the auditor has reason to believe based upon other public data that the individual is not eligible to vote, this will help avoid them from getting registered. Paragraph B of Section 1 was deleted in the author's amendment, so I won't cover that. Section 2 provides an affirmative defense to the crime of illegally registering to vote if the person has submitted a written request to have their voter registration withdrawn, has not been charged with the crime, and has not voted. It also changes illegally registering to vote for those who have not voted from a felony to a misdemeanor. Sections 3 and 7 provide the Secretary of State's office with data on felons currently serving probation, both before and after elections, so that voter records can be flagged to prevent felons from voting or unflagged if they've completed their sentences. So election officials do not currently have access to this complete data set, and so it will provide us with information about people on probation that we do not currently have, which will allow us to more accurately flag records before the election and identify anyone who has voted illegally afterwards. It also requires the Secretary of State to send a written notice to felons prior to each state general election to warn them not to vote if records show that they are still serving their sentence, and notices to those who have completed their sentences to let them know that the right to vote has been restored. Section 4 moves responsibility for investigating voting violations from county attorneys to law enforcement agencies, and it also requires county attorneys to follow the prosecuting standards currently set by the American Bar Association as they review and charge alleged violations of election law. Section 5 prohibits the sending or delivery of absentee ballots to anyone who provides the address of a facility that houses felony-level offenders only. Section 6 provides that a signature on the voting roster is legally sufficient evidence of an intent to vote. And Section 8 requires that probation agreements for felony-level offenses include written notice that the individual is prohibited from voting. So as Senator Chamberlain said, this bill does several things. It provides notice in several additional ways to individuals, making sure that they know that when they're prohibited from voting. It also provides notice to individuals to let them know when they are allowed to vote. It provides election officials with additional information to flag and prevent people from voting who shouldn't, and to catch them if they still do. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Chamberlain.
Yeah, a couple of quick things. There are several components in here that are judicial related, the penalties, et cetera, just as a reminder. And I do have, do all of you have the report, the interim report in your packets? If not, I got some copies here. Should be enough for everybody.
I have one. Did everybody else have one?
Nope.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I got that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Roebling.
I'm just wondering for a little clarification. Now, you will be notifying prisoners in our prison where only felony convicted inmates are housed that they won't be eligible to vote, but
no.
I didn't think we'd have to, but I was wondering because you did cross out some existing language on page 2 that the last known residential address that is not a correctional facility. I guess I just wanted to make sure that we didn't have to send anything to them, and yet I know that sometimes county jails house both gross misdemeanor offenders and felony offenders, and I just am wondering how those will be dealt with.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, the section in which we send the notices is Subdivision 2, which is on the bottom of page 3 and the top of page 4. So that's where in the author's amendment, the author's amendment deleted Subdivision 2 and has all new language. But this is where we would send the notices prior to the election. And we would not send it to people who are in prison, but only to people that are in the community, either on probation or on supervised release. Was there a second part to your question? I'm sorry.
Senator Roebling.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering that as long as It says that they would get a list. The Department of Corrections shall provide the Secretary of State with a list of offenders who, at the time the list is prepared, are serving a felony sentence or are on probation. So the list is just a list of inmates in the prisons, right, so that they can check against that list if anyone should send a mail-in application for an absentee ballot. Is that what the intent is?
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, no, the intent is that this list would provide everyone who is serving a felony sentence. So it would include people on parole or supervised release, as well as people on probation who have never necessarily been sent to prison. The current language of the law under the previous subdivision
provides, has the Commissioner of Corrections provide our office with information on felons who are serving under the jurisdiction of the Commissioner, which is about 20% of the felon population. It only includes people who have actually been sent to prison, which means that we're not currently getting information or a list before each election of the 80% of people who are under community corrections and serving probation. So this will give us a much more complete list so that we can flag anyone who is eligible or I'm sorry, who is registered to vote and can catch them if they do vote. The part about prisons is particularly around Section 5, which requires that the commissioner provide our office and we provide the counties with a list of facilities that only house felony-level offenders. And if somebody submits an absentee ballot application, you know, care of Stillwater Prison, for example, we would then have that address and know, the counties would know not to send a ballot to whatever the address is that goes with that facility. It also requires that the Department of Corrections staff, who sort the mail anyway, ensure that if a ballot is sent there, which it shouldn't be, but if it is, that it's not provided to the inmate, or if somebody brings one in and hands it to the inmate, if they try to mail it out, that it is not sent out.
Thank you.
Mr. Ferber, is there Mr. Ferber here to testify?
Yes.
Can you state your name for the tape and proceed?
My name is Tom Ferber. I'm a member of the Governor's Elections Task Force on Election Integrity, serving with Senator Chamberlain. I represent cities. One of our main concerns regards to making voting at the polling place for our election judges a understandable and easier process. And one of the things that we want to do is make sure that the best we can notify and identify felons, then there's less chance that they're going to be in the polling place and less chance that they be voting illegally. In addition, we want to make sure that felons that have completed their sentences and have their rights restored to vote also are identified and know that they can vote. And so we are in favor of this legislation and proposed bill that the senator has brought forward today, and we want to support it because it will make the job of our election judges and our local election officials easier.
Okay, thank you. Questions for Mr. Ferber. Senator Kalish?
Well, I'm not sure for Mr. Ferber. Mr. Fraser, is there a fiscal note for this? Because I don't have it in my packet. What's the... I'm guessing there's a cost to both corrections and the Secretary of State's office,
Ms. Fraser.
Maybe local units of government.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kalish, there is a fiscal note. I know that we completed our part, and our part for the mailing and for processing the data this year was, for our office, was around $50,000, and I don't know what it came in for the Department of Corrections for their part of it.
We don't have a fiscal note here. I understand they're still working on it. Or, oh, Ms. Lexi, Ms. Stengel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kalish, there is a draft fiscal note. It hasn't been completed yet. I think, as Beth Fraser said, she can talk about the costs for their department. I don't know if anybody from Corrections is here to talk about that, but otherwise we don't have a fiscal note to hand out yet.
Okay.
Senator Kalish.
Can I follow up? And, one of my questions also is that... do we have a number of felons in the state of Minnesota that this is going to affect both? How big is the mailing list? Those kinds of things. Can you just go over approximate numbers on that so we get a better idea where that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Kalish, my understanding from information provided by the Department of Corrections is that there are approximately 49,000 people serving felony sentences at any given time, and there are approximately 10,000 people each calendar year who will be discharged from a felony sentence. So this would require us to mail approximately 50,000 notices to people warning them not to vote and approximately 20,000 notices to people in any two-year period telling them that their right to vote has been restored. In terms of the fiscal cost, the proposal is to use the Help America Vote Act funds to pay for these expenses, and Senator Perry is carrying a bill that would appropriate those funds.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to propose the A4 amendment.
Senator Eaton offers the A4 amendment.
It's not in there. She's just...
Senator Eaton moves the A4 amendment. I believe everyone's going to have one in a second here, so could you explain your amendment?
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to propose that we amend the bill, or actually the statute, Section 2, Subdivision 2A, to restore civil rights for felons. The purpose would be an individual is not eligible to vote because of incarceration in a state or local correctional facility for a felony offense is restored to civil rights as soon as the individual completes any incarceration imposed and executed by the court for the offense. If the individual is later incarcerated for the same offense, the individual's civil rights are lost only during the period of incarceration. And that section pretty much summarizes what the other four pages say. I think this would save money, obviously, as we're talking about the fiscal note. I think it would save confusion in the local elections. I think it would help a large number. I know it's nationwide. It's about 2 million people of color who are unable to vote because of this law. And I also think that we encourage people to get back involved in their communities and civic life.
Senator Eaton, could you tell us, would this include those who lost their right to carry a weapon? And would those people be included in your amendment?
If they are incarcerated for a felon, they cannot vote. Otherwise, they can't.
So, Senator Eaton, what does your amendment do then? It restores
voting rights once you're released from prison.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Senator Chamberlain.
Senator Eaton, just quickly, this is the North Dakota model, incarcerated, non-incarcerated. There's about 12 others, 13 states across the nation that do this sort of thing. And I appreciate Senator Eaton's desire, and we discussed this for a few hours during the task force, and it is addressed on page one, at the bottom page one, number one, and it goes over to the next page. The task force did talk about this. We did listen to North Dakota Secretary of State. We did believe at that time it was worthy for further discussion, but however, as a task force concluded, as you can see in this memo, that as a task force we concluded that it was not the proper time and needed more discussion and more evaluation and analysis before we decided to do it. And we picked it up fairly late during our discussions and our meetings, so we just felt it needed more time. And at this time, I'm not prepared to take that amendment.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Chamberlain, I just felt that since we're spending a lot of time making a very confusing process into law, and expensive to notify a lot of people and make sure everybody's keeping track of everything, that it would just make common sense to allow these people who've served their time to vote.
Mr. Chair, Senator Eaton, as I said, we don't necessarily disagree with the idea, but we did not have enough time to discuss it and evaluate it. It was the conclusion of the board, all members on the board, that what you see in front of you is we want to discuss it more and look at it more, but we were not prepared to make a recommendation to the Senate to the legislature to pass that to put that into law. So appreciate it, but that just wasn't the conclusion of the folks sitting on the board.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would oppose the amendment also. You know, Minnesota uses community corrections a great deal, probably at one of the highest levels of anywhere in this country. So we lock up far fewer people for shorter periods of time than almost anywhere in the country. And so when we say that they've served their time, they serve their time both in prison and out on probation with restrictions that come with that probationary period. And so I would hesitate to say that everyone who has served their time in the prison should now be free to have all of their rights restored, should be eligible for that, because we don't retain people in prison as long as many other states. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. We've done that for years, and I don't think that it's caused us a lot of problems. And other states look upon our community correction system favorably, and many of them would like to be more like us. But at the same time, I think that serving in or out of prison, there has to be some additional restrictions until that entire sentence is fully served.
Senator Eaton.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Roebling, I guess I wanted to clarify that this only affects voting rights, not all their rights. It doesn't say they can carry weapons or own handguns or whatever. But also wanted to say that I don't think that a felon being released from prison is any different than they are going to be 6 months, a year, or 2 years from then as far as their voting habits. If they are more likely to be able to vote, they're more likely to join into their community, to become part of the community, to be less likely to offend. This has been shown statistically, and I don't have them with me, but I can hand those out. And it's all part of the, as the Second Chance group has said, that if you don't let people be part of the community again, if they can't vote, they don't have a place to live, don't have a job, how are you encouraging them to follow the law?
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Eaton, in looking over your bill or your proposal, this is not a new discussion in the Minnesota legislature. We've had this discussion before, and we've had it in the Senate especially. The question I might have is how do you think the victims of those felons would think about restoring partially their civil rights? Quite often we have victim statements that we seek when we release someone, even to probation or parole. Have you done any research on whether or not victims have any sympathy toward a felon, especially a felon who's been convicted of a personal crime of violence? Have you done any research on that?
Senator Eden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Limmer, as the mother of a victim of a violent crime, I can tell you it would not matter to me one way or the other whether the person voted or not. That is not at all in uppermost my mind, but it may be in some.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer,
there's a number of us who've had very close relatives who've been victimized by others. I have a particular relative who was brutally raped, and quite honestly, I wouldn't want to restore any rights to that individual until his sentence is commuted. I think when you start talking to the public, at least the public in a lot of the areas I've brought this up over recent years, there is a resounding no from the audience when I speak to them. I understand the restorative concept that you're trying to instill in the state of Minnesota, but I'm not quite sure we're ready for that. And there are certainly other areas to try to encourage a person who's made maybe a heinous mistake. They victimized one or others, might be repeat offenders. I don't know if I need to go to the 609 chapter book and read every heinous crime into the record, but if we did, I think we might want to reconsider that. I know that this is considered a baby step toward restoring someone's sense of belonging to a community. And for all of those purposes, I would say maybe that's a good idea, but at the very moment they're released from incarceration without having proven themselves, I'm not so sure if I'm ready for that.
Okay, Senator Sieben, did you have a...
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to add that I serve on the committee that Senator Chamberlain and the Secretary of State are the Secretary of State is the co-chair of, and we began to have this discussion in the committee, and recognizing that there are very sensitive arguments to be made on all on both sides of the issue, that was one reason why the committee chose not to advance this proposal at this time. However, we did hear, as Senator Chamberlain said, we did hear from the Secretary of State of North Dakota, where, as he alluded to, they do have this provision. And it, interestingly, when asked by the committee members, he said it never really became a political issue. And, of course, this used to not be the case in Minnesota, and it was added relatively recently in comparison to our of our statehood. So I think that it's something that we should begin to not begin. We should continue to have these discussions around, and I just want to thank Senator Eaton for raising the issue, because I think as the public begins to understand more that the tremendous cost, speaking in terms of financial costs here, that having this type of election provision in our statute, it is so expensive to administer for local units of government, especially to administer this, and for the state, that, you know, it's obviously a very delicate issue, but I do think it's something that we should continue to explore and look at what other states do, to see if we can find some sort of agreement around this in the future.
Senator Harrington, and then there is a testifier who wishes to address specifically this amendment. So, Senator Harrington.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. A couple of quick points. One, I appreciate Senator Chamberlain and Senator Sieben's comments about the North Dakota model. It does strike me that in an era of tight dollars, that if there is no problem, and North Dakota certainly seems to indicate that there is either little or no problem, that it would be fiscally irresponsible for us to continue down a line that spends money. So far what I've heard, and we haven't seen the fiscal note yet, but the Department of Corrections has a fiscal note to this. The Secretary of State has a fiscal note to this. Currently, the county attorneys who have to do the investigations have a local fiscal note to this. And according to this, local police departments will be having to do the investigations on this, which will still kick it back to the county attorney or city attorney at some point. So there will be anywhere from 4 to 6 different fiscal notes of a cost to following up on something that effectively we're saying in other places has had virtually no problem whatsoever. So that would be part of the argument that I would have here. The second piece of that is that, and I certainly appreciate, I used to chair for about 10 years, I chaired the Crime Victims Reparation Board here in Minnesota, and I used to, on a monthly basis, hear the horror stories from the victims of violent crime here in Minnesota, and as a cop, I got to firsthand be the person sometimes that took the reports from them. So I would like to think of myself as someone who really champions the victim. I think the cops are we're the people that speak for the victim when nobody else is there, oftentimes is not. It feels like we have catastrophized the victim experience so far. I make no bones about it. For those folks who have been beaten and assaulted or raped or robbed at gunpoint. It is a horrendous and heinous crime. But the vast majority of felons in the state of Minnesota are property offenders. They are felony theft, they're burglars, they're folks who have committed a property crime and not a violent crime. And so if you were even going to parse this out even that way, it would seem to make sense that we should look at perhaps, if you want to take a baby step here, at least talking about those folks that are felons that have been convicted of property crimes. The reality is for a lot of those felons, we keep talking about them being let out of jail. Here in Minnesota, a lot of them never go to jail. They get convicted, and they're put on probation, and they spend their entire time out in the community, paying taxes, working, raising their family, doing all of the things that we want them to do. And for that group especially, saying that they are – that this part of their civil rights, that the schools that they send their kids to, they shouldn't be able to vote for the referendum on those or for the school board members, the cities that they live in, that they shouldn't be allowed to vote in those elections. To me, it seems like we are taking something away from them with no real cause for concern, because if we really were concerned about the judgments that they had made, I would argue that we probably would have – made the judgment that they needed to be incarcerated and actually lock them up instead of saying, no, you've made a grievous mistake against the community, but we're not going to put you behind bars. We're not going to eliminate, take away your freedom. We're simply going to have you report to somebody. And oftentimes with our property crimes offenders, as I think Senator Limmer knows well, the level of intrusion into their lives is pretty minimal on our property crimes offenders. So I would like to speak in favor of Senator Eaton's motion.
Mr. Haas. Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the tape, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Mark Haase. I'm the Vice President of the Council on Crime and Justice, which is a Minneapolis nonprofit that works with ex-offenders, victims of crime, and we do criminal justice policy and research work. We are also a member of the Minnesota Second Chance Coalition, and today I am speaking on behalf of that coalition as well. We're a coalition of over 55 organizations that support reasonable chances for people who have criminal records. I wanted to thank Senator Eaton for introducing this amendment. I had planned to testify on this issue, although I wasn't aware that this good A4 amendment was out there. And I'll be brief. I want to add a few statistics, relevant statistics to this discussion. One is that the percentage of Minnesotans disenfranchised because of a criminal record has increased 500% since 1982. That's research compiled from Professor Chris Eugen at the University of Minnesota. 500% the rate of people disenfranchised because of a criminal record. This is because we've increased the number of felony crimes and we've increased the sentences for felony crimes. Yes, Minnesota has a good model. We send our most serious offenders to prison. The vast majority, in fact, 87% of our disenfranchised residents live in the community, work to hold jobs and pay taxes. The rest we send to prison because they've committed serious crimes or repeat offenses. We've realized that people can be more successful if they stay in the community. So even looking at the victim issues, the punishment issues, if we don't allow people currently in prison or jail on a felony sentence to vote, as this amendment does, we're still restricting the right to vote. However, for those who are And I will add something else about the Minnesota model. We do rank fourth in the number of individuals per capita under community supervision, which means probation, supervised release, or incarceration. And again, the majority of those individuals are living in the community, 87%. The Minnesota model weeds out the most serious and repeat offenders for prison. And the reason we do that is because we've made a policy decision that people can be more successful when they're in the community, when they can hold down jobs, pay taxes, stay connected with their families. There has been research that has begun to show that voting can have a link to reduced recidivism. And so actually, if you're looking at the public safety aspect of this, allowing people who are in the community to vote and be part of the democratic process could actually possibly reduce recidivism. In fact, since the Secretary of State's task force report came out, I've been informed that the
Minnesota have a pretty full agenda. Could you wrap it up?
Yes, I'm wrapping it up, Mr. Chair. I've been informed that the Minnesota Correction, I'm sorry, the Minnesota County Attorneys Association has looked at this issue and voted to support the North Dakota model. And I assume they're looking at this from a cost as well as a public safety perspective. I do have now the notice, the underlying notice bill. It's hard to argue with notice. I have a we don't support that. We support the A4 amendment, but I do have a recommendation for a slight amendment to the underlying bill, but I think I'll just work in the House, and I don't know if this bill will go to another committee, but work with the author on that possible little tweak to that.
It's
that
going bill. To judiciary. So.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Senator Chamberlain.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, just one final comment on this is that, as I said, there's 15 members of the task force that met regularly, and we did discuss this briefly. Well, I would agree with the general concept and further conversation about this issue. I would believe it unwise to go against the recommendations of the committee at this of the commission at this time. It's a worthy thing to discuss, Senator Eaton, Senator Herring. I would agree. I've spoke to members of Second Chance. I also agree that it's with them that it's worthy to discuss. But the task force concluded that at this time we don't want to have it to be part of the legislation. That we would discuss it further and pick it up later. Thank you,
Senator Harrington. Quickly, please.
Okay. Senator Chamberlain, Mr. Chair, I was wondering if you would entertain an additional line into your bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Harrington, anything is possible.
Okay. Can I give you some verbiage?
Please do.
Six in line 6.24.
Senator Harrington, we are on the amendment to the bill. Is this to the bill or to the amendment?
That's
right.
It's to the bill.
My apologies.
Maybe we should get the amendment out of the way. Senator Limmer.
Thank you. Mr. Hossie was here, still here. I couldn't help but hear the use of the word disenfranchise as if it's something that someone else is depriving an individual of a right to vote. In the dictionary, it says to deprive of a franchise of a legal right or of some privilege or immunity. In Minnesota, if the person who is the felon commits a crime, that person is depriving himself of the right to vote by victimizing someone else. I see that clearly as the action of the actor, and being found guilty, it's the consequence of his action. When one victimizes an innocent neighbor or other citizen on the streets of our state. But I don't equate disenfranchisement with that action. A disenfranchisement is when you're, at least in my opinion, when you're trying to deny someone to influence their place in society, such as a vote. And so it's a word that we use quite often, but I think in the context I would find it to be slightly different. And it kind of goes to the very, very argument that we seem to be a society more and more that doesn't want to own up to its own responsibilities, its own actions, its consequences that when they victimize someone else. And I suppose we could be saying that we could deprive someone of the right to travel because they happen to be a felon and we put them in jail to protect all the other citizens in the state that might be weaker or at least not street smart to see the intent of a threat coming at us. Now, is that our fault that that person is now in jail? No. It's because of their own actions. Is it a fault of society that we take away their civil rights, a variety of civil rights, because of their actions? No. And so, as I look at the amendment, Mr. Chair and members, I find that, and I think Senator Roebling's made mention of an idea that I had never thought of before. Minnesota is, I think, number two lowest incarceration states in the country. We do not rely on prisons to punish everyone that commits a crime in Minnesota. We try to reserve those to the individuals that are a physical threat to themselves or to the rest of our society. The reliance on probation and parole is heavily used, and as a result, the loss or deprivation of civil rights is actually a good thing to add to what some might consider a light sentence when we're relying on probation and parole as the means to do that. Mr. Chair, I'd like a roll call vote on this amendment.
Roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call on the amendment. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Limmer, we have a criminal justice system in this state that when people do wrong in society to others and they have a punishment, and then they serve their punishment because we don't think that that's good for society, of course, and so they're punished. And then when we want to integrate them back into society, when they're done with their punishment, we do put them on probation, parole to get them back oriented back into society. And as part of that, I think voting would be one of the things that would help them get back integrated into society. They are disenfranchised if we don't allow them to start getting back into feeling empowered in their community, to start being citizens. We want them to be good citizens. Now they've served their time. They wronged society. They were punished, and now they're getting back into society. And this seems like a start to getting them back into where they feel that they can be a part of society. That's what we want them to do, is to feel empowered to take responsibility for their actions and to be empowered. I spent 10 years doing civic education, and we know that when you feel a part of your community, when you're part of the process, when you vote, that then you really are more a part of the community, and then you take better care of it. So I think this would be a great start to get them back into the back into being a good citizen.
Senator Eden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to add that I think if this was a good idea for the task force thought this was a good idea, it is. I mean, why? Because they didn't decide to pick it up, I don't know if time was short or what, but I certainly think that it's time. And the reason why I think it's time to deal with it is that we're going through this complicated bill of notifications and mailing out. And I mean, the voter problem was that a number of felons voted who shouldn't have. If they could have voted, we'd have had virtually no voter fraud in the state. I would like to suggest that this is cheaper, that it's effective, and it takes care of the issues that we've had. It also, you know, California has this law, Colorado, New York, Connecticut, and South Dakota. So I guess I, rather than go through all these changes and require all this paperwork of passing names back and forth between agencies, I think this is the time. If this isn't the time to do it, when is it?
So your argument is if it wasn't against the law, there wouldn't be any fraud. So if we get rid of all the laws, there won't be any crime.
No, sir, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would have to disagree with Senator McGuire. Being on probation isn't just part of being reintegrated into the community. Being on probation is still part of the punishment. And so, you know, we're still thinking of their loss of some freedoms and some things that people who are not in that circumstance normally get to exercise. And I don't think that's inappropriate when you're still being held accountable for a crime that you committed. But, you know, one of the things that I don't think many people think about, and I was surprised when I heard that the County Attorneys Association may have endorsed the idea behind this amendment, because it troubles me to think that people who sheriffs have arrested and county attorneys have prosecuted could vote for them or their opponent, and most likely it would be their opponent, in instances where they have where they're out on probation. Well, they're still serving their sentence. And I just find that an odd, that would be such an odd circumstance if their sentence is not commuted yet, that they could be voting, you know, for or against the people who have actually put them into that situation where they found themselves serving a sentence.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the intent of this amendment and second chance. I mean, this is a world of second chances. And quite frankly, recidivism is a huge problem in our correction system. It's become a revolving door in some cases. So I appreciate the intent to get to that. But I can tell you, having been a director on the board for the Rochester Network for Reentry for 6 years, which is a nationally recognized reentry program that has had fantastic success, do you know what? Voting never came up as one of the issues to help men and women reintegrate successfully back into society. What was important was jobs, secure housing, helping them with education, financial education, literacy education, working with the families, working with their children who are at a much greater risk of incarceration, and actually the one-on-one personal involvement by committed citizens in the community to work with those who are coming in and out of who are coming out of prison. So I think we would be fooling ourselves if we thought for one moment that restoring voting rights would be a great success in reducing recidivism or helping with successful reintegration into society.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you. Thank you. I just wanted to say that I think that the voting rights is not something that in itself that restoring their voting rights is going to keep them out of prison. I think it's a piece that could. I think that the recidivism is expensive, and it's, you know, basically I think you made my argument for me. The felons don't, not that many of them who are coming out of prison care if they can vote. It's mainly the felons who are out in the community who are contributing, paying taxes, working. They've shown that they can be responsible in every way in the community. Certainly they should be able to vote on the rules that are affecting them, children's schools, as was mentioned. And I guess that's what I have.
Senator Kalish.
Yeah, one of the things that I keep looking at this is this amendment streamlines the process. It saves money. These folks that have been convicted of felon have already been a burden on taxpayers as it is. They cost money to prosecute. They cost money to incarcerate. They cost money up and down the line. And here we're talking about the ability to have a simple rule that when they get out, they're allowed to vote, and it doesn't cost the taxpayers any more money to make sure that they don't vote. It's not going to be earth-shaking, I don't think, as far as the vast numbers that are going to influence a prosecutor's or a county attorney's election or a local sheriff's election, as Senator Roebling suggested. But in the end, it's like, you know, we want to make this simple and streamlined government. Here's an opportunity for us to do that. And it's not that it's unproven. It's been proven in other states that it works well. And as far as the timing goes, you know, one of my questions, I think, for anybody that's on the task force, whether it be Senator Chamberlain or Stephen or Mr. Ferber, is that what was the arguments against making this the other than the fact that you didn't have enough time to discuss it? It seems to me like it's like they were going in that direction, but they didn't have enough time to discuss it. I don't really catch the argument against implementing this at this time, especially with the lukewarm response from the committee that checked it out. So,
Senator Chamberlain, to that point.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kalish, it did come along late in the process, and again, while it is worthy of further discussion, we didn't have enough time to fully vet it. And again, it was 15 members that decided we would put it in here as further discussion, but not include it in the legislation. And I would add that just because something is simple and easy and right, simple and easy does not necessarily mean or equate to being right. And I think we need a little more time to digest this and go forward and perhaps take it up a later time. But a lot of things we put in this provision, this bill, will help save money and improve efficiencies, especially at the county attorney level.
Okay, a roll call being requested. The assistant will take the roll on the amendment.
Vandeveer.
No.
Chamberlain.
No.
Eaton.
Yes.
Harrington.
Yes.
Kielash.
Yes.
Cruz.
No.
Limmer.
No.
McGuire.
Yes.
Nelson.
No.
Peterson.
No.
Reinert.
Yes.
Roebling.
No.
Sieben.
No.
Wolf.
No.
There being five yeses and nine noes, the amendment is not adopted. Mr. McGrath, did you want to testify to the bill? Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the tape, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dan McGrath. I'm the executive director of Minnesota Majority. As you're probably aware, it was our organization that did the primary research discovering the problem of felons voting in the first place in Minnesota. In addition to the nearly 200 convictions that we're now approaching, over 1,000 more ineligible felon voters appear to have participated in the election that haven't been and won't be charged. So there's a pretty significant number of people that we know about who voted who shouldn't have in the election. When you look at how close the election was in 2008 in the U.S. Senate race, we can all understand why that uncertainty is unacceptable. So I appreciate the effort put forward with the authoring of this bill to try to address this problem. It's not a panacea, but it does improve notification to felons about the state of their voting rights, being sure to inform them when their rights have been revoked, when they're restored, wouldn't have stopped those who willfully defied the law, but I might stop others who simply didn't understand the restrictions involved in their probation. So I support that concept. Positive proof of having been informed would also assist prosecutors in proving intent when an ineligible felon is caught voting. I have two concerns about the bill. First and foremost, Section 4 takes the responsibility to investigate and prosecute voter fraud allegations away from the county attorneys. I know that some of the county attorneys have complained about having that statutory duty, but there's a good reason for it. It assures that there is one person who can be held accountable for failures to investigate and prosecute the very serious crime of voter fraud. The law, as it now is designed to ensure that there is no prosecutorial discretion. Voter fraud is a threat to our republic, and the laws against it should always be enforced without exception. Voter fraud can have political implications. If an option is given, some may choose not to pursue charges against the perpetrators for political or other reasons. And so for these reasons, I'm opposed to Section 4 of this bill. My second concern is in Section 2 of the bill. Changing the crime of registering while ineligible from a felony to a misdemeanor will likely result in lesser penalties being applied to those found guilty later of voter fraud. This is because typically those convicted of voter fraud are initially charged with both the crimes of registering to vote and voting while ineligible. What's also typical is that the judges in those cases pick one or the other, dismiss one charge and prosecute, get a plea for the other, or convict for the other. So if the choice is there, what we've seen is the judges will more than likely charge convict for registering at a misdemeanor level rather than slap the felony sentence on these offenders. So there's some concerns that I have with the bill. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Mr. McGrath, who would be enforcing the law now if the county attorneys aren't doing it after the changes in this amendment?
Well, with the changes, Mr. Chairman, the changes that are proposed here would take the responsibility from the county attorney to investigate and hand it over to local police, which on its face may seem to make sense to a lot of people because normally investigations are handled by police. But the county attorneys, in turn, have been turning those investigations over to either the county sheriffs or the county police departments. So they have the ultimate responsibility to see that it's done, and there's one guy, not just kind of a nebulous law enforcement that would have prosecutorial discretion, but there's one guy that you know you can go to. It's his job to get it done. And I think that's the way it should be.
Okay. Senator Chamberlain, is Section 4 important to you?
My belief is that Mr. McGrath perhaps has some valid points, and we discussed it briefly, something I have not discussed at length. I have referred to other people as well to get some better insight. This has to go to judiciary, and I believe this, Senator Lindner could correct me if I'm wrong, this would be an issue that would be dealt with at judiciary. So we're open to some thought about how that would work. I think part of the process and the reasoning for this Section 4 issue in Section 2 was to kind of streamline some of these issues because there were some of the mandates and the strict requirements and penalizing felony simple errors and oversights with felonies. If I recall, that was correct. Senator Sieben isn't here, but maybe Ms. Frazier can address those two pieces well. But overall, I think we can look at those two pieces and address them in the judiciary as well.
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair and members, this section is especially important to the county attorneys, and it would be helpful if somebody from their organization could speak to it and to the exact changes that it would make. I know that they feel like they're forced to bring charges in cases where they couldn't possibly win, which isn't necessarily a good use of government resources, but I can't speak to it much more than that.
Well, Senator Chamberlain, I can wait on the amendment if it's going to judiciary. Otherwise, I'd like to move to remove Section 4, but I'll let it go since it's going to judiciary anyway, and maybe can take it up on the floor if that's the case. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Chamberlain, if I can direct your attention to line 420, this makes reference to an accordance with the American Bar Association Criminal Justice Section standards regarding the prosecution function. I'm not even sure what that sentence may mean, but even if it is a reference that you're claiming, could you try to, by the time you get to the Judiciary Committee, provided it passes here, give at least a date or a reference to this criminal justice section, if you could find that for us so that we know exactly what we're talking about, especially the date. 5-6 years from now, there might be something in accordance with the American Bar Association criminal justice section that may have changed. And without it having a reference of at least a date, I think you would be having a never-ending change and confusion in law if we aren't specific.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, I don't disagree. I think we should review that section more carefully. And I was going to contact Pat Diamond. I got someone else looking at it as well. So we can certainly address that and tidy it up and make sure it satisfies everybody.
Any further discussion? Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, also, I know that we've had a lot of discussion about election law and how we affect and demand performance on the existing law. It used to be that everything went to county attorneys. Now we've kind of changed it to if there's an election violation. And I think this might just be focused more on the candidate's performance, but it goes down to the Public Disclosure Board, and then they have a review first before it goes any further. And then when it does go further, it does not go to a criminal prosecution. It goes to a civil prosecution. So I don't know if this section, Section 4, is making any changes to that existing law or not. I'm seeing that Ms. Frazier is shaking her head no, so I think maybe I'm focusing just on candidate performance. And if there's a violation of a candidate breaking a campaign law, it would go to a review first by the Public Disclosure Board panel, and then it would go from there to be qualified for any other further court action, but needless as that may be, you may want to inform us if this goes to judiciary, why are we changing to a law enforcement agency? Quite often, law enforcement agencies may see a violation of a vote, of a person practicing a vote when they're not necessarily approved to do so. They haven't met the condition of voting. I'm not sure if in other elements if that is a lower standard than going to a county prosecutor. I don't know. So if you could be prepared to give us some more advice on that.
Okay, seeing no further discussion, Senator Chamberlain moves that Senate File 2043 as amended be recommended to pass and we refer to judiciary. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no.
No.
The motion does prevail. Senate File 2043 as amended is recommended to pass and we refer to judiciary. Thank you, Senator Chamberlain. Members, Wednesday we will not be meeting. We do not have anything on the agenda. We will be meeting Friday as our plan afternoon, so watch for the schedule on that. And with that, members, we are now adjourned.
It is unusual, so we have
no. Yeah. I've tried to. I went to get an amendment to the bill. He told me not to do it because we're not on the bill. After that, I just adjourned it. I don't know. I'm a little puzzled.
Oh, the sections. That was the one that was weakest on.
Yeah, I know. I was too. I was trying to.
They had to. Well, I knew it was going to go to judiciary, so it wasn't that much. But thanks.
Thank you.
Puzzled by the. I thought they. I'm now.
You want to carpet straight
itself? Yeah.
If you figure that out, let me know.
I'm
going to step out for a few minutes. I'm going down to education ground.
Still serving their sentence, and about 20,000 people that have to meet the same.
No, actually, I was just.